Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and we are excited to announce that there is a replacement for the retiring David Letterman.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems, and I'm committed to earning your confidence back by fixing the site.
That's right. Kathleen Sebelius is leaving the Department of Health and Human Services after the Obamacare website fiasco to maybe, say, do a real comedy show on CBS. I guess Stephen Colbert might be available.
No one has signed up for Obamacare, give or take 4.2 million people. And our president has gotten so desperate that he appeared on this website, Funny or Die. By the way, Funny or Die is also the ultimatum you get from Obama's death panel.
And that must mean Stephen Colbert from Comedy Central is going to HHS just in time. And if you believe that, I promise we'll sort all of this out later this hour. We'll also explore just how encrypted you need to be when your own computer software can give away your passwords. Also, actor Colin Firth will be with us this hour to talk about his role playing a man who had a chance to settle a score with his World War II torturer and found forgiveness instead.
It's very difficult for me to comprehend. I've never experienced that kind of brutality. I've never experienced captivity. I've never been in the presence of someone who wants to degrade me comprehensively.
That conversation coming up later this hour, but we begin with some thoughts on the 50-year commemorations of the Civil Rights Act.
Today, we remain locked in the same great debate about equality and opportunity and the role of government in ensuring each.
President Barack Obama, this country's first African-American president, speaking yesterday at the Civil Rights Summit in Austin, Texas, at the LBJ Library. But here's something that there's not much of a debate over right now.
We have the biggest prison population in the history of prison populations, right, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have this epidemic of white-collar crime that is worsening rapidly. And maybe one day we all wake up and realize how unfair it is, and that could be a serious problem in this country.
Journalist Matt Taibbi said that on this program earlier this week, and it goes right along with this fact we will explore in just a moment with journalist Jeffrey Toobin.
Every single inmate is black. Not most of them, not a lot of them, every single one.
All black prisons. That's what Jeffrey Toobin is talking about. They're a facility in Baltimore, Maryland. But in a rising prison and parole population, quadrupling since 1980, breaking all records in the history of civilization, the correction system in America is probably the biggest example of how in certain areas civil rights have not advanced in the past 50 years. The overrepresentation of African-American males in the prison population in racially segregated facilities is a feature of American life today that would shock Lyndon Johnson if he were alive today. Joining me now in the studio is Michael Jacobson, director of the CUNY Institute for State and Local Governance and professor in the sociology department at CUNY Graduate Center. He's also a former New York City Corrections and Probations Commissioner. Michael, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How much does the prison system in this city, in cities across America, represent a complete besmirchment of the notion of civil rights in America?
Well, as one of the clips you ran made clear, the prison and jail systems are overwhelmingly, disproportionately people of color, right? They don't look like the states or cities that they're in. And that's been true in the U.S. for about the last 40 years or so, even more so as we've ramped up our system from having about 200,000 to 300,000 people in jail and prisons to 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today.
And part of that is a function of American politicians thinking that prisons are the solution for everything, and also the decline in mental health services, a whole series of declines in the justice system that have produced this explosion in the prison population.
Correct. It's the coming together of several sort of structural issues, sort of tough on crime environment, a sort of war on the urban poor, the drug war. All these things have combined to allow politicians to get sort of cheap political capital by becoming tougher and tougher on crime, longer and longer sentences, putting people in jail and prison for less and less serious crimes. And you add all that up cumulatively and you have what we have, which is 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners.
Which is shocking for America's first African-American president to be presiding over.
Right.
And is this a system that can't be turned around, or do you believe the administration has chosen not to address it because it's too politically sensitive.
No, I think it can be turned around. And if you've been listening to Attorney General Holder the last couple of years, he's really sort of ramped up his comments on prisons generally, the disproportionality in prisons,
mandatory minimum sentences.
So the good news – there's not much good news here. But the good news here is that for the first time in 40 years, in the last 3 years, have seen declines in the number of people in state prisons. And a number of things have caused that. But essentially what's happening now in states is that they're all coming to the realization one way or another that these systems are too big. Their scale is too unaffordable. There's too much anger about it. And there's so much research that shows it's ineffective and doesn't work that policymakers and even very conservative policymakers have become sort of more enlightened about the need to downsize these systems.
Will they take action though? I mean, you heard all this rhetoric at the Civil Rights Summit down in Austin, Texas, saying there's more work to be done. We need to do more work. Right. But in fact, the Civil Rights Act was passed in a moment of crisis in America. And if you look at these numbers in the prison system, this is a moment of crisis.
No, that's correct. You know, the question of will they take action, you know, if you look at Texas, 3, maybe 4 years ago now, passed the most sweeping prison reform legislation of any state in the last 40 years. And no one would have predicted that, right? And they did it because of a coming together of all these sort of structural issues. It's too big. Texas can't afford it. They have too many other problems in their health and education system. And even in a bipartisan way, they made a very conscious effort to take money out of their prison systems, about $500 million, and reinvest a lot of it in rehabilitation and community programs. There's a ton of more work to do in Texas. I don't want to be sort of overly sanguine about what they did, but it was sort of symbolic that even a state like that is now sort of ready or at some level of a sort of precipice to make some reform. So I do think we're at a moment. The question is, can we take advantage of the moment to do some really serious reforms to drive down our rates of incarceration similar to those of other Western European countries, which are all about one-fifth of ours, give or take?
Michael Jacobson is director of the CUNY Institute for State and Local Governance. He's a professor in the sociology department at CUNY Graduate Center and a former New York City Corrections and Probations Commissioner. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All of those problems we just discussed and more could be found in the last decade at a single correctional facility in Baltimore, Maryland. Before it was partially cleaned up by the feds, the Baltimore City Detention Center was in the hands of the inmates and run by the Black Gorilla Family Gang. They ran the jail as their own criminal enterprise, literally employing the prison guards as smugglers, enforcers, and in some cases, lovers. Jeffrey Toobin went into the BCDC facility to write a profile for the New Yorker magazine.
I think all of us knew at some level that there were these things as prison gangs, but what really astonished me about what went on in Baltimore was not just that there was a gang running the jail, but that the guards were complicit and the guards were mostly women who were under the sway of men with whom they were in relationships.
And, you know, it's part of the story in ways that relate to where this prison is, the neighborhood that it's in, the stresses socioeconomically in Baltimore, and the fact that at one time, 75% of the guards were women at this facility, partly because men couldn't get these jobs.
Well, that was part of what attracted me, is in addition to sort of the sordid details of what was going on at this jail, it was a window into what was happening in Baltimore. Men in Baltimore cannot pass the screens that are required for a job in a jail like this. You know, you need to not have a criminal record. You need to have a high school degree. You need to pass a drug test. Unfortunately, large numbers of men in this overwhelmingly African-American city cannot pass those screens, so they can't get these jobs. So you have overwhelmingly female guards, and they are in some ways in relationships, in some ways consensual relationships with the inmates in the jail.
And part of this employment situation that you describe is an opportunity for the Black Gorilla Family, the gang running this facility in Baltimore, to actually recruit women to become employees and then become the agents of an enterprise within this jail.
Right. Yet another, you know, social problem that is reflected in this piece is that lots of people in jail have big drug problems, addiction problems. So they're a very good market if you can start getting drugs and cigarettes and booze into a jail. So the Black Gorilla family recruits and corrupts these female guards, gets them to bring in cell phones, which are the critical ingredient here because they pass money through the use of codes on cell phones. And then these corrupt guards bring in the drugs that meet the demand of the addicted inmates. It's a perfect system in a way.
Can you convey how confident this man who eventually was convicted or at least apprehended and pulled out of that facility, Tavon White, how confident he was that he ruled this facility and how his relationships with women reflected a long-standing misogyny of the Black Gorilla family going back decades?
Right. Well, the Black Gorilla family was founded by George Jackson, the famous 60s radical in California, author of the famous book Soledad Brother, which I don't think people realize just how sexist it was. I mean, this attitude towards women as lesser beings has a long history. And Tavon White, who was the head of the Black Gorilla family in this Baltimore facility, you know, he had five children with four different guards. Two of the guards had his name tattooed on their body. The control he exerted was really extraordinary, and the contempt that was reflected. And I have to say, it was really sobering for me to walk around this facility, which is known as BCDC, and every single inmate is Black. Not most of them, not a lot of them, every single one. In a city that is 65% African-American, and, you know, to have an all-Black jail is really a very troubling and disturbing commentary on what goes on here. I have to say, I don't really feel any sympathy for the gang members who are running the place. I mean, I think those are just stone-cold criminals. I did have a measure of sympathy for these women who were the guards, who clearly should not have been doing what they were doing, but given the choices that were available to them, they clearly made bad ones, and I don't endorse them in any way, but I did have a certain degree of sympathy for these women who were cut off from men in many respects and were manipulated.
When jail is worse than prison, what does that say about our criminal justice system based on your investigation here?
It's a lot about drugs, that virtually all of these inmates were in for drug offenses of one kind or another, and just the pervasiveness of that problem and the ineffectiveness of the law enforcement response, and that we don't know what to do with people. One of the inmates who was involved in this scheme, you know, again, I didn't have much sympathy for him, but when he went to his sentencing, he said to the judge, he said, "Look, you know, I've been in jail." He was about 25 years old. "My entire adult life, this is the only world I learned." And yes, he did wrong and shouldn't have done what he did. But, you know, he was saying something meaningful there, too, that jails and prisons don't make people better.
Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker. His profile of the BCDC facility is in the current issue of The New Yorker. He's a legal analyst for CNN. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, John.
Today, President Obama made it official. Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, is moving on.
Under Kathleen's leadership, her team at HHS turned the corner, got it fixed, got the job done, and the final score speaks for itself. There are 7.5 million people across the country that have the security of health insurance, most of them for the very first time, and that's because of the woman standing next to me here today.
I got to be a leader of HHS during these most historic times. We are on the front lines of a long overdue national change, fixing a broken health system. Now, this is the most meaningful work I've ever been a part of. In fact, it's been the cause of my life.
After 5 years on the job, Sebelius claims she's going out on a high note, having already taken partial credit for the more than 7 million people who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act. She will be replaced by Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So an OMB replacement for Sebelius, that means this is a caretaker position for the last 2 years of the administration, do you think?
Oh, no, hardly. Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is going to be responsible for shepherding Obamacare through the next era here. Don't forget, Kathleen Sebelius leaves a couple of months before a midterm election when really the only thing that Republicans are running on is what they call the failure of Obamacare. So caretaker, no. Ms. Burwell, when she's approved at HHS, and I'm here to tell you that she will be approved because of Senate rules unless something goes drastically wrong with this nomination, will be responsible for making the technical case. There are a lot of decisions, by the way, important decisions that Kathleen Sebelius made as administrator at HHS, regulatory decisions, for instance, delaying the employer mandate, the thing that says employers have to cover health care under Obamacare for their workers, 50 employees or more. That was delayed. When to turn it back on, that's going to be Burwell's decisions. Lots of other things, dozens of other regulatory decisions under Obamacare that will be under her purview.
So she's a manager, though, not a visionary, which suggests that we're going to be managing and shepherding, as you say, not doing any fundamental new initiatives.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's an accurate take on it. The new initiative is the Affordable Care Act, and the midterm election is what it is. We should also go inside the Senate for a moment to look at the timing here. There has been plenty of scuttlebutt over the last 2 months that Kathleen Sebelius was on the way out. The actual announcement was a surprise. But given how hard Republicans went at her and what a bad debacle the website was at the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, everybody thought that that would probably be the beginning of the end for Sebelius. Now, don't forget, if it were any other time in Senate history approving an HHS nominee to run Obamacare in this political environment would be really, really hard. But remember the nuclear option? No, 51 votes. Republicans can't stop her because they can't force 60 votes on Burwell. Not only that, when she was approved for White House Budget Director, John, 96-0. She's well-liked by Republicans.
But they certainly can't prevent a showcase for more criticism of Obamacare at the confirmation hearings. I'm wondering why the administration would want to go there during the election. I mean, not that the Republicans need much of an excuse to have a showcase to criticize Obamacare.
And that's exactly what Republicans are looking forward to. Several Republican aides that I was in contact last night when this news broke, they said, fine, this is yet another billboard for us. This is what we're running on. Confirmation hearings will make it tough. On the floor, we'll make it tough. Not necessarily for Burwell herself. She'll be fine. But in defending the law, again, it's the only thing that they're running against. I can't stress how important it is for Republicans to continue to vilify this law. You heard Sebelius in testimony yesterday touting 7.5 million people signed up. Another 3 million enrolled in Medicaid expansion. They expect a couple hundred thousand more. So that will definitely be the playbook for Republicans, John. There's no question about it. And we should say, statements from Republicans last night, it was remarkable. Dozens of them came out. Only one or two kind of threw shade on Kathleen Sebelius. You know what all these statements were? They said, thank you for your service. Nobody could have done a good job with this law because the law is a terrible train wreck. And so you can see the Republican positioning there. It's not about one person. It's not about Burwell. It's not about Kathleen Sebelius. It's about Obamacare. That's their election strategy.
But the president has really left her holding the bag here, Kathleen Sebelius. And I wonder what that means for Burwell going forward, how cautious she has to be about this White House.
Well, hey, welcome to politics. You know, welcome to Washington, John. I mean, that's what it's like to work for the big man, I suppose. She does get some of the blame for the debacle of the website. She also gets credit for the big fat number that she got to tout yesterday. We'll see how. Look, we're not going to know whether this is a success for another couple of years, the financing and the overall success of Obamacare. But politically, hey, that's the way it goes. That's why people sign up for these jobs.
Does the next president inherit a need to really consolidate health programs at HHS, that really we're looking at a reorganization at some point when Obamacare is actually fully up and running?
HHS is the biggest agency in the government. People don't know that. They think it's the Pentagon. But when you combine Medicare, Medicaid, and all the other medical programs and the huge budgets they have and Obamacare now, it is by far the biggest bureaucracy in the United States government. People have been wanting to consolidate them forever. There's a lot of money that flows through there, John, and cutting off the spigot's pretty hard.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Later this hour, the many personalities of Stephen Colbert.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have great news.
I made the debate team.
No, I'm sorry. I should rephrase that. I have great news for me. You didn't make the debate team.
My office. Burgled. Plundered. Purloined. Ha ha ha. Loins.
I spoke with Democratic strategist Hank Shinecoff about what the loss of the porn vote means to his party.
It's pretty clear the Republicans are the big tent party now.
We don't care about pornographers. We care about working people.
These people are hardworking.
As you can hear there, there was life before the rapport for the very talented Stephen Colbert, and there is a life after it. Colbert replaces Letterman. Savvy move or sellout? Maureen on Facebook. He's got theater charisma, political savvy, humor and wit. Anyone would be happy just to sit across from him for a chat. Don't get me wrong. I'm still a huge Fallon fan. Just happy to see this late night balance. Not so fast, as says Linda. They've co-opted him. He was the main competition in that time slot. He won't be the persona we've come to love. Mainstream media wins. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Should Colbert replace Letterman? Sibelius join the cast of Game of Thrones? More on this story later this hour. Stay with us.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie time on Friday, and this week we've got lions, tigers, bears, cartoon birds, football players, and haunted mirrors.
Oh, my.
As always, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer join us, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Rafer Guzman is also a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, producer extraordinaire. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John. John.
So let's get to the mirrors first. Oculus, big release, horror film. Let's listen.
I found it.
What do you mean?
We only have a few days.
A few days for what?
To keep our promise and kill it.
We were just kids. We made up a scary story so we wouldn't have to accept the fact that our father was a sick man who killed our
mom.
Dad kills mom. Is Oculus a synonym, Kristen, for mirror? What does that word mean?
I should know that, but you know, on the podcast this week, we were actually talking with a mirror historian who knows all about superstition, mirrors as sacred objects and so on, and he's going to explain a lot about that to us.
I suspect that might be more interesting than the movie.
The movie is actually quite scary. You have a father who's possessed by a mirror. Once he's possessed, he kills his wife. He tortures his kids. His kids have to kill him, but then they want to go back as adults and kill the mirror as well. And there are some scary moments in it, but I felt in the end it was a little bit of a cop-out, which a lot of horror movies tend to be at the end.
But movies that begin with the word O are scary. Omen, Oculus. I mean, that is scary. O is a scary letter. All right. Rio, on the other hand, not so scary. And this is a sequel, Rio 2.
You guys are late.
Clock late. But musician early.
Wait. You guys are coming?
Okay. I guess I'll go.
Amazon jungle or bus, baby.
Who is ready for a tropical adventure?
Woo! I know I am. Let's
wait, wait. Wait, we didn't do a head count. Hey, guys, wait up.
No more calls. We have a winner. If you guessed George Lopez, Jamie Foxx, Rachel Crowe, Jamie Foxx, George Lopez, and Jesse Eisenberg, you got the voices right. What do you think of this, Rafer?
Well, I was not a big fan of the original back in 2011, and this one is not that much better. I do like Jesse Eisenberg, who plays the voice of Blue, the endangered Spix McCaw. He's kind of a Woody Allen-ish urbanite Spix McCaw. That's kind of funny, but this is a lot like the first one. There are no new ideas here, although it'll be interesting to see what Fox News says about this, because it's very pro-environmental and very, very anti-business, and which I know the Fox News people have been hammering the kids' movies on lately. So we'll see what they say about this.
All right. Both of you saw Draft Day, which is timed for the NFL draft coming up. Kevin Costner back in the movies with Jennifer Garner.
I owe you. I drafted you.
Your dad drafted me.
No, Drew, I drafted you because I believed in you.
Then why pick Callahan?
You know why.
Then trade me.
I'm going to do what's best for the team.
The best thing for this team this season is me.
Now, the sports radio buzz on this movie is so profoundly negative, I cannot tell you. What did you guys think of it, Rafer?
Well, I'm not a big sports fan, so I'm going in very cold on this with no preconceptions. It's directed by Ivan Reitman, who did Ghostbusters. I like him. I think the movie is really zippy and fun. I think Kevin Costner is actually really good as the general manager of the Cleveland Browns, but I do think the plot is pretty wobbly and does not make a lot of sense. If you can overlook that, then you might have a pretty good time with the movie.
Zippy enough for you, Kristen?
Unfortunately, no. I think it's always a challenge to show people doing the equivalent of accounting. Two of this, one of that, trade this for that. It is like watching an accountant balance a checkbook. And unfortunately, it's not the most exciting checkbook and it's not the most exciting accountant. This isn't Moneyball. It's mediocre at best.
But would you like any NFL movie ever, Kristen?
You know,
do you think?
I I think that there might be one out there. I just have to think really, really hard.
North Dallas 40.
Longest yard. Longest yard. Maybe, maybe. All right, Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer. You guys have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
The co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast, which you can find at thetakeaway.org. Finally, after years of riding the zeitgeist...
The Obamacare website is a disaster, and I am loving it.
After years of playing one of the most loathsome, lovable characters in television...
Obama started this gun-tracking program in 2006 when he hypnotized George Bush. Then, he secretly ordered Attorney General Holder to order the Justice Department, to order the ATF, to order gun shops, to sell guns to Mexican drug cartels, and then lose track of them, thereby panicking Americans to gin up support for the draconian gun control measures that Obama has never introduced.
Stephen Colbert has finally found a way out of the character he created. The right-wing, bombastic narcissist who shares his name, Stephen Colbert, is going back to being Stephen Colbert.
Our first guest is the host of the Comedy Central television show, The Colbert Report, and this is his new children's book. It's entitled, I Am a Pole and So Can You. It will be available in bookstores May 8th. Here he is, the always entertaining Stephen Colbert, ladies and gentlemen.
As the entire world knows by now, Stephen Colbert will replace David Letterman as host of The Late Show, and he will host that show as himself, or someone besides that other guy named Stephen Colbert, when the show debuts in 2015. Alan Sepinwall is the author of The Revolution Was Televised. He's a television critic at HitFix. Alan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You think Colbert can pull this off? Can he actually break character here? This is the way out of the box he created for himself.
It's the way out of the box he created for himself, but I think we have ample enough evidence from things he's done away from the Colbert Report that he as himself is a very funny, very charming, very smart guy. I think he can do it. I'm really going to miss him, though, as quote-unquote Stephen Colbert.
I mean, throughout the Colbert legacy, he would not break character. There was that celebrated moment where he was at the radio and TV correspondents' dinner for a George W. Bush and gave a terrifying performance where he did not break character at all. It's almost hard for him to do, it seems like.
Well, I think he's just very committed to it, but he's also talked about the fact that, you know, his kids are getting to the age where they've seen the show and he's not necessarily comfortable with them thinking of him as this guy. So I think he very clearly, this is what he wants to do. He set up his last several contracts to all end exactly whenever Letterman's contract at the time ended. So he's been aiming for this job for a while, and he wants it. The question is, what's he now going to do with the show? Is he going to do the exact same talk show that everybody else has been doing for the last 50 years?
He's a sketch comic in many ways and a skilled improv actor. He's a great interviewer on his show, but can he be as much of a generalist as Letterman and Carson and some of the really successful late-night TV hosts have been?
I think he can be. I think he's a personable guy. He, as you say, he does good interviews, and he does these really complicated interviews that are half performance pieces. I think regular interviews are going to be easier for him. And if you go back and you watch a lot of vintage Carson did characters. You know, he did the psychic. He did the sleazy salesman. I think Colbert almost certainly is going to work some of that into this show, even if he's not playing the guy from the Colbert Report anymore.
Let's talk about CBS. What a crazy, risky decision, choosing a white guy to do a late-night show, huh?
Yep, it's when Chelsea Handler leaves her show in a little while, it's going to be all men, and Arsenio is going to be the only non-white guy in the bunch. So I think Colbert is the most qualified candidate who is available and interested, and you can't ding anything in terms of his resume, but in terms of uniformity of voices, it's really unfortunate. I would hope that whoever winds up replacing him on Comedy Central is not another middle-aged white guy.
All right, so Colbert goes to Letterman. He's a huge success. Will he be invited to the Comedy Central Daily Show Christmas party, or will they just hate him if he stomps Jon Stewart?
I don't think so. Well, first of all, he and Stewart aren't going to be in direct competition. He'll be on against whoever his replacement is. And Stewart has been on record saying, I don't want the job, and I think Colbert would be perfect for it.
Finally, is there a place for a satiric Rush Limbaugh character in American comedy now, or will that go with Stephen Colbert?
I hope that there's still room for satire. I don't want someone to just try to duplicate what Colbert was doing. I would like to see something new, but I don't know. I certainly don't think that CBS is going to want him to be doing much, if any, of that, which is unfortunate.
Alan Sepinwall, the author of The Revolution Was Televised. He's a television critic at HitFix. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Combination. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes. That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
Hey, folks, you really clever people out there with the password 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like on your luggage locks or your birth date or your kid names. You got a problem, folks. Heartbleed, the flaw in the network encryption software that was revealed to the public this week, is going to be a day of reckoning to any of you out there who keep your passwords in your own memory. The Heartbleed flaw infects not only computers, but network routers, where security data is parked for nanoseconds on its way to your Facebook page or Instagram site. Making yourself secure just might mean going back to school to get a degree in computer science. Or at least, it means you got to change your passwords. Julia Angwin is a skeptic by trade and a worrier about digital security. Her book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance, is the story of just how hard it is to keep those invaders out. Welcome, Julia.
It's great to be here.
What do we do about this?
I mean, this is a real challenge of the internet in general, which is that as a decentralized network, it's so robust, and that's the strength of the network, but it's also the vulnerability that we all have to defend our own castles. And we're not the greatest defenders. You know, we are not trained in computer security. And so for each one of us to try to diagnose these issues and then figure out a fix is difficult.
And, you know, we don't want to do it. We would love to just have one little password, one little click, and not really be concerned every time, a pop-up ad comes onto our screen that, you know, we might be compromised. How do you defend your castle? I mean, how much brick and mortar does it take to actually do that in your experience?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I try to come up with as many defense mechanisms as I could while still not disabling my ability to live in the modern world. And the truth is, it took a lot of time and energy just simply addressing passwords, for instance, was like a months-long effort to identify which passwords I had. And then, because the real best practice is not to have the same one on each site. Well, it turns out I have like about 70 passwords. So, you know, changing them all, even though I used an automated service to generate them. And then, of course, when something like this happens with Heartbleed, you're supposed to change them all. And I actually can't tell you how much I'm dreading going in and doing that.
Everyone is. Absolutely. Everyone is. And, you know, every time you click on that, should I remember this password box in your own computer, it immediately triggers you to forget it. So if you have to, you first of all have to find out what is the password, get it figured out as to whether it's compromised or not, and then go about changing it. And then you have to save it. And then, you know, maybe the process will be repeated again if one of these bugs is found again.
Correct. So one thing that I have made a sort of philosophical decision about with managing this stuff is that my brain is not set up for this. So I try to automate everything and have computers do these tasks for me. So I use a password manager, 1Password. There's LastPass, KeepPass, a lot of them out there. And they remember all my passwords. Now, my husband thinks it's a real pain because he'll say to me, can I log into your whatever account? What's your password? And I'm like, I have no idea, honey. I don't know my passwords. But it allows me to offload this task, which our brains are not equipped for.
Doesn't that potentially compromise your security in that if the LastPass server is compromised, then you have to change services?
Right. Well, so my passwords, all these password services are not stored on their servers. It's encrypted file on your machine, and only you can unlock it. So theoretically, that makes it somewhat safer. The truth about computer security is you can never be perfectly secure. The goal is to be more secure than everyone else so that the criminals will go for the low-hanging fruit. So my basic feeling is, yes, somebody who really wants me, the NSA, they really want me, I'm pretty much toast. But if it's, you know, just the regular criminal, they're probably not going to break into my 1Password file.
Because your neighbor is much, much easier.
Because my neighbor's password is most likely 123456 or password, which are still the two most popular passwords out there.
So sad.
Yes.
That is so sad.
It's very sad. We all need to up our game a little bit.
If you go overboard on this and attempt to, you know, enforce a kind of personal paranoia, what kinds of functionality do you start to see go away? What kinds of difficulties do you have if you overdo this on protecting your castle?
Well, I already have sort of overstepped the line. I mean, even my simple password manager, I refuse to store a backup in the cloud, which means that when I use multiple devices, I have a hard time transferring my password file. I have to carry around a little stick, a thumb drive, plug it into my new computer. You know, it's a little old school and seems, you know, I thought it seemed a little paranoid until all of a sudden Heartbleed came out. And I was like, see, I was so smart.
Look at that smile on your face. And that is the smile from security. Right. You have. OK, maybe you're a little old school, but you definitely have the security that everyone else dealing with this Heartbleed doesn't have.
Right. Except for the fact that I still have to go change 70 passwords.
Right. Is the way of doing this, you know, clear in your book? Do people other than you recommend actually doing this? Or is this the kind of thing where most consumers are just going to blithely go along?
Well, probably most people will blithely go along, but I think that most people should understand, though, that if they're going to do one thing, change your email password, because that email password can be used to reset all your other passwords. So if you've ever seen, you know, the enter your email address for the resetting link for your forgotten password. So your email is the key to unlock all your other accounts. So I would recommend that if you're going to do one thing, change your email password. And if you have multiple email accounts, do all of those.
And in terms of password resetting, are there phishing programs that will encourage you to do a reset when actually what you're doing is allowing somebody else to get your password?
Oh, yeah. You should never reset when you get an email saying to reset. That's a sure sign not to reset. The only time you should reset is if you go to the site, log in. It's also worth pointing out that with Heartbleed in particular, you shouldn't reset until you can verify that the site has updated their software. And so there's a bunch of different Heartbleed status checks out there. You can enter the name of the website and see if they've updated their software. And once they are approved and gotten past the Heartbleed bug, then you can rechange your password.
You know, there's a level of complexity here, and you alluded to it in the beginning that, you know, we have these open source, you know, robust networks. The level of complexity of the software is such that, I mean, this Heartbleed bug wasn't a bug. It was a kind of unintended consequence of a very, very complicated program. We're going to be finding much more of this as time goes on. In a sense, we're in a perpetual beta test in this new world.
Yeah, and you know what we are? We're in a beta test where we're not paying our engineers. I mean, people are relying on software written by volunteers. That's what these open source movements are, is basically people who – it's the one giant Wikipedia project, people who contribute code in their free time. And I just – I'm all for that sort of utopian vision of the world. But the truth is, if we want this stuff to be as secure as possible, I think we're going to have to pay people money to do it.
Julia Angwin is an investigative reporter at ProPublica and author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And don't try to crack her bank account. It won't work. Guarantee you.
I try. Thank you.
And if you're wondering about some of the websites vulnerable to this Heartbleed bug, Mashable has put up a handy list. We have a link to it on our website at thetakeaway.org. According to that list, Gmail, Yahoo, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, Pinterest all need a password change. Twitter is unclear. Full list again at thetakeaway.org. You've given us some great stories this week about people you would love to have the chance to settle a score with from long ago. People you might have been mean to in high school, you'd love to be able to apologize to, or someone who made you feel bad, you'd love to confront in some way. We will leave you this week with an amazing story along these lines. A man, Eric Lomax, a British officer, given the chance to confront his Japanese torturer from a brutal World War II labor camp.
I worked for the War Graves Commission. They needed interpreters. We traveled the railway. We find dead bodies. We identified them. We brought them here to be buried properly.
So you went up the line, you buried the man you helped to kill.
That's when I saw so many bodies, so very many. I had not imagined so many had died.
Murdered. The word you're looking for is murdered. So many had been murdered.
Actor Colin Firth playing Eric Lomax confronting his Japanese torturer Nagase Takashi, who Lomax tracked down in an amazing true story behind the movie The Railway Man, opening in limited release today. Colin Firth, who plays the late Eric Lomax, and Patty Lomax, Eric Lomax's wife, shared with us this story about forgiveness and redemption that has at its core a love story. Patty Lomax could always see in the man she loved the torment within him. that together as husband and wife, they would find a way to put to rest.
Well, that's simple. It was right from the very beginning when we first got married and started to live together. And the nightmares were very prevalent, for instance. It was very confusing, very frightening, because he couldn't speak about what the problem was. And it was a matter of living with this awful knowledge that there's something badly wrong with the person I loved, but couldn't reach him.
How did the discovery that Mr. Takashi, his torturer, one of his torturers, was still alive, how did that change the situation?
I think I can answer it best by telling you of the first occasion that he saw his psychiatrist with me present. Eric was absolutely joyful, a totally different person. He had got this man, the man that he hated so much, and he had a fix on him. It was a change of personality, in a way. And then, of course, he really concentrated on trying to meet him. But it took a long time. He wanted to do Mr. Nagase great harm.
And as an actor, how challenging is it to go from a feeling of revenge that is life-sustaining to this redemption and sense of forgiveness that he comes to?
It's very difficult for me to comprehend because I've never experienced that kind of brutality. I've never experienced captivity. I've never been in the presence of someone who wants to degrade me comprehensively. The only way I could understand it is that the journey that we're looking at is actually the love story. It happens via his marriage. It happens via Patty. I can't conceive of it happening in any other way, because obviously you can't nurture yourself on hatred. And if you love somebody and somebody else if that person is also a casualty of your pain, which is what I think began to happen to Patty and his own children, then something then conflicts with that agenda. It was not just Patty's love for him and patience with him and determination to get him helped. He actually realized he had something that was worth battling with the bitterness for.
But Patty, did you feel that he was giving you a gift as well as doing something essentially to save himself emotionally?
I don't think that I can say that I thought of it like that. It was much more a journey of he himself reaching within himself with great courage to face his demons, overcome them, and become the person that I knew because of the other side of his nature, that he could be. And from that point of view, as Nicole says in the film, she loved him. She wanted him back.
War leaves a mark, Mrs. Lomax.
But I don't believe in this code of silence that you have. I really don't. And you may be determined to stay screwed up and suffer for the rest of your life, but I don't want that for Eric, and I can't live like that. He's a wonderful man. I've seen it. I love him, and I want him back.
And in having him back, although it was never totally complete because the damage was so deep, it was a very joyous thing.
How fearful were you that his journey to meet with Nagase Takashi would result in him committing some act of violence?
Oh, very, very, very worried.
You might have lost him forever.
I could have done, yes. Yes, it was right up to the last moment. I think Eric probably told Colin. Eric intended to kill that man.
So what a challenge for an actor when you're in that moment to not do that.
It's a very stark experience to sit over lunch with somebody very sane and civilized, and be asking questions about their intention to kill somebody. And it was so matter-of-fact. I mean, that's what made it impossible to doubt. And I said to Eric, because I was, hedging around it. I mean, how do you ask somebody if they meant to kill somebody, you know, and you're sitting politely with people you haven't known for very long, and you're saying, but were, Eric, were people around you aware of this, your intention to and he just very, very matter of fact said, kill him. And he just, oh, yes. He knew he was going to do it, and he knew how he was going to do it. He'd thought it through. He had the methods, he had the idea. He'd lived it in his mind.
The years I've spent imagining I'd found him, making him beg, making him scream. Oh, I've nursed myself to sleep on that sound.
And he thought that was his resolution. It's very difficult for us, and we found in talking about it together, that it's very difficult for us to actually identify what it is that turned him around, if you call it a turnaround, but why he didn't go through with it.
Did you think Eric Lomax had that forgiveness in him?
No, not at all. He hated the Japanese with such intensity, and it had been such a long-held obsession of his. The only way I can describe it, and I think perhaps Eric would agree, all of a sudden he was faced by an elderly gentleman, the same age as himself, not that young Japanese face in Japanese war uniform. Mr. Nagase was very obviously very contrite. And I think Eric, in a sense, took on his old army training and became, as a gentleman officer, which he had been, would act. And it was just a tremendous relief. But I would hate people to think that it's just a war story. I'm proud to think that, yes, it is a love story, and it's a love story with a very happy ending.
Well, Patty Lomax and Colin Firth, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colin Firth plays Eric Lomax in The Railway Man, and Patty Lomax is the wife of the late Eric Lomax. They both joined us in the studio. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.